when you need to talk technology. No one gets you more gigs in your hard drive than Adam. It's time for Adam the Computer Guy with Adam Lepp.
And a very good Tuesday morning to you, March 12th already. Daylight savings time is upon us. Spring is coming soon. Looks like a nice few days ahead of us. Weather will warm up, but you know, we may get a little more snow before we say goodbye to Old Man Winter. Never quite know. That's part of the fun of living in Ohio. Adam Lepp here, the Computer Guy, with my twice weekly radio program all about technology and the world around us and how to technology, computers, GPS, robotics, virtual reality, and all that good stuff. How does that intertwine with the great world around us? Speaking of weather, we had a rather detailed conversation with our resident weather reporter, Mr. Zach Fuller, last week. He is doing weather forecasts every hour, as you probably know, offering tornado safety tips, as this is Tornado Safety Week. Tornadoes are obviously potentially very dangerous, but they're also very interesting. That's kind of how weather is. Sometimes the most interesting aspects of the weather can be the most dangerous. And as we study them, we can learn about them and take them seriously and also take precautions when necessary. So please do listen to the tips that Zach is offering all week. And if you missed my program with him last week, it's in our archives at our website, wwgh1071.com, discussing tornado safety, weather technology. He's furthering his education in weather and even getting a little political, discussing climate change and is it or is it not something that we need to pay serious attention to. All that and more last week on the Adam the Computer Guy radio program. Lots of tech news to share with you this week. Some very generous severance pay packages going out to former Google employees. Of course, Elizabeth Warren, not one to shy away from opening up her mouth. Well, she's talking about if she were to become president, she may very well want to break up Amazon and other large tech companies. That's all coming up in the news headlines that we talk about here on the Adam the Computer Guy program. So sharpen your eardrums. We're going to stimulate a few brain cells. And like any program on this station, just a little bit of controversy. And of course, especially on my program, not one to shy away from the wisecrack. Because, you know, laughter is the best medicine. Want to remind you that coming up after the 10 o'clock features, it is Talking Points with the gentleman who always has a lot of points to talk about, Mr. Satch Sullinger. Don't want to miss that program every Tuesday for your listening pleasure and edutainment. And that's a cross between education and entertainment. Every Tuesday morning between approximately 10:13 a.m. Eastern and noon. After the noon features, it is the interviewer to the stars, Scott Spears. Open phone lines and trivia the first hour. And then he speaks with Dr. Ron Feynman between 1:13 p.m. and 2. Dr. Feynman usually joins me on my Monday program, which we call Mid-Morning Coffee Break. Don't want to miss that. Later today, it'll certainly be lively. And again, more than likely, quite controversial also. So now let's go ahead and talk today's top tech topics on The Talking Place, WWGH Radio, and broadcasting online by the power and magic of the internet at our website that is maintained and hosted and programmed by yours truly, so you know it's going to be a good one. WWGH1071.com. Here on the Adam the Computer Guy radio program on The Talking Place, WWGH Radio, we discuss business news from the world of technology because it kind of goes hand in hand with what goes on in the world around us. sometimes gossip, political ramifications, and everything in between. So what's going on at Google? Kind of hinting around that some of these big tech companies may be in a little bit of hot water, or at least embroiled in controversy, just to make things fun. Google has agreed to pay $135 million, which is not a lot of money to Google, but to me, it's a lot. That money is going to two former executives accused of sexual harassment. Now, we've found out from a newly unsealed lawsuit that former senior search VP Amit Singhal was initially offered $45 million, but he ended up getting $15 million. Still, not chump change by any means. Now, that amount was first reported by CNBC, which noticed a newly unsealed shareholder lawsuit against Google. According to the lawsuit, former head of Android, Andy Rubin, allegedly received an offer for a $150 million stock grant, which he then allegedly used to negotiate the $90 million in severance pay that was in the news. Now, Amit Singhal, again, initially offered $45 million. He got an offer of $15 million because he joined a rival company, Uber. So again, these guys do not always play well with others. Now, the news of these payouts, originally reported in the New York Times, led to protests on Google's headquarters last November. Now, in the case of Andy Rubin, the former head of Android at Google, because Android and Google kind of go hand in hand, his $90 million severance package automatically canceled out the $150 million stock grant he was initially offered, so he didn't get both, as some publications have reported. In the end, he got $90 million, and again, Singhal got $15 million, $105 million total, lower than the $135 million which Google had originally approved. Either way, these folks are getting some very large severance packages, and they can retire for life. Now, these payouts were approved by Google's Leadership Development and Compensation Committee. It alleges that other Google executives allowed Larry Page, Sergey Brin, and Eric Schmidt to dominate the board committee and influence the decision to pay Rubin and Singhal. Francis Bottini is a lawyer for the shareholders. He didn't immediately respond to a phone call requesting comment. Google said that there are serious consequences for anyone who behaves inappropriately at Google. In recent years, we've made many changes to our workplace and taken an increasingly hard line on inappropriate conduct by people in positions of authority. Now, the shareholder lawsuit, what does it accuse Google of doing? Well, breaching its fiduciary duty, abuse of power, unjust enrichment, and corporate waste. It asks for a trial and calls for Google to handle future sexual harassment accusations better. It's also seeking punitive damages without demanding a specific amount of money. The lawsuit is 202 pages. It has 119 pages of media reports from the Wall Street Journal, NPR, BBC, as evidence to back up claims that Google enabled rampant sexual harassment from senior executives. The lawsuit quotes an anonymous Google employee who said, "When Google covers up harassment and passes the trash, it contributes to an environment where people don't feel safe reporting misconduct. They suspect that nothing will happen, or worse, that the men will be paid and the women will be pushed aside." So some pretty serious stuff here, and some rather large severance payouts, to say the least. Now, back in November of 2018, Google employees protested how the company had handled sexual harassment complaints. In response, Google agreed to end its forced arbitration policy in cases of discrimination and harassment. It also promised to end pay and opportunity inequity and make its annual internal report on incidents of sexual harassment available to all employees. So some hot water over at Google, and some people definitely walking away with large severance packages, and no doubt some people not overly thrilled with the entire situation. It really is a shame that a large company that people, myself included, use multiple times every day has to be embroiled in some controversy. Well, speaking of controversy, one of the most controversial and certainly colorful politicians, she also might be running for president, never quite know nowadays, would be Elizabeth Warren. So, what's going on in her neck of the woods? Well, Facebook removed a number of ads placed by Senator Warren and her presidential campaign. That's according to Politico. So why did they do that? Well, the ads target tech companies like Amazon, Google, and Facebook, and were placed after Warren announced that she would work to break up Amazon and possibly some other large tech companies by reversing large acquisitions if she were to become president in the 2020 election. Probably heard about that, and we've talked about that on the air. Shortly after reports surfaced, Facebook told Politico that it would be restoring the ads that it had taken down. A Facebook spokesperson said, "We removed the ads because they violated our policies against use of our corporate logo. In the interest of allowing robust debate, we are restoring the ads." According to Politico, the ads that were taken down were identical and used the same images and text in each one. Warren's ads point out that without placing ads on Facebook, the campaign wouldn't be able to spread its platform or message as efficiently due to the company's sheer size and ability to target specific voters. The ads read, "Three companies have vast power over our economy and our democracy. Facebook, Amazon, and Google. We all use them, but in their rise to power, they've bulldozed competition, used our private information for profit, and tilted the playing field in their favor." Warren recently told The Verge that she's also calling for the breakup of Apple. Now, the ads that were briefly taken down were replaced with text that read, "This ad was taken down because it goes against Facebook's advertising policies. They have policies against using Facebook's logo and name, and they have policies that relate to, not against, but relate to, using Facebook's logo and name in advertisements." A Facebook spokesperson told Politico these rules were why the ads were originally removed. Or was it because Senator Warren, if she were to become president, would want to break up these large tech companies? You really never quite know, because these guys have a lot of power. So in a tweet, Senator Warren responded to Facebook by saying, "Curious why I think FB has too much power. Let's start with their ability to shut down debate over whether FB has too much power. Thanks for restoring my posts, but I want a social media marketplace that isn't dominated by a single creator." Senator Elizabeth Warren recently announced that if elected president in 2020, she would work to break up giant tech companies like Facebook and Google. "It's the most stringent proposal from any lawmaker, capping off a steady increase in calls for antitrust action against Silicon Valley from the Justice Department and other regulators." So, some serious possible campaign promises from Senator Elizabeth Warren running for president, as well as 1,001 other people and certainly getting right there in the mix with the big guys, Facebook, Amazon, Google, and who knows, whomever else. And we'll see what happens with that. Will the government even consider breaking up these big companies, or will they not get involved? Certainly that will come into play in the election. Well, if you're like me, you are fed up with robocalls. Comedian John Oliver is one of many Americans who feels that way. The FCC, according to him, is not doing enough about robocalls, and I would agree with him. He has sent robocalls after the FCC in revenge. He recently announced on HBO's program Last Week Tonight that he's going to send robocalls to the five FCC commissioners, Ajit Pai, Michael O'Reilly, Brendan Carr, Jessica Rosenworcel, and Jeffrey Starks, every 90 minutes to hopefully annoy the FCC into taking action. He notes that it only took his tech guy 15 minutes to set it up. The repeating call, again from comedian John Oliver, getting back at the FCC for not doing enough about robocalls, and I agree, they are not doing, they're doing very little about it, and I'm not happy either. The robocall says, "Hi, FCC, this is John from Customer Service. Congratulations, you've just won a chance to lower robocalls in America today. Sorry, but I am a live person. Robocalls are incredibly annoying, and the person who can stop them is you. Talk to you again in 90 minutes. Here's some bagpipe music." So, John Oliver getting back at the FCC, and I think he's taking the right approach. Give them a taste of their own medicine. Let's take a trip out to the Orient, to China. What are some of the best Chinese phones that Americans cannot buy? At this year's Mobile World Congress, a lot of interesting goings-on were shown as existing outside the great United States. 2018 was the year that Chinese manufacturers made a firm claim to be producing the most exciting and experimental phone hardware in the world, with wild designs from the likes of Oppo and Vivo. Cool-sounding brands there. Others are competing on different terms, making phones of surprising quality at prices that American buyers could only dream of. Companies like Huawei and Xiaomi have demonstrated some of the most attractive foldable phone designs in history. So, what's going on there in China? These super-duper smartphones that you can't get here in the United States. Well, Xiaomi again, is spelled X-I-A-O-M-I. Their flagship Mi or Mi series tends to combine high-end specifications, conventional design, and low prices. Kind of speaks my language. The Mi 9 from Xiaomi. So it is a notched 6.4-inch OLED display, a Snapdragon 855 processor. Check this out. I mean, my computer at the office rivals this. 12 gigabytes of RAM. Pretty cool. On a smartphone, an in-screen fingerprint scanner and a triple camera system with three separate focal lengths. Not much groundbreaking about the Mi 9 itself, unless you care about wireless charging speed, but Xiaomi's ability to price a 6GB of RAM, 128GB of storage variation on this phone for U.S. equivalent of $450 continues to be a big advantage of the company. And really, you take a look at that versus what you can get from Apple and Samsung at that price. It is quite superior. It makes me a little envious there of what people in China can get. The Xiaomi Mi Mix, Mi Mix 3. Not sure if it's pronounced me or my, but I guess either is okay. But anyway, this fancy-dancy smartphone from Xiaomi in China is a higher-end line. So what does this phone do? Well, it's thicker than you might expect. It has a 3,200 milliampere-hour battery, and it's, due to its size, not always easy to operate one-handed. has a magnetic slider mechanism to raise the selfie camera from behind the uninterrupted screen. Coming in May, there is a 5G version. Price, again, still not bad, $475 in U.S. dollars for a 6 gigabyte, 128 gigabyte storage model. It's still at least as compelling, according to the experts, as the Mi 9. Again, especially if you don't like notches. So good stuff coming in the smartphone field out there in the great country of China. Adam Lepp here, thanking you for listening. AdamTheComputerGuy.com. Nowadays, in many areas with DoorDash, Postmates, Grubhub, Uber Eats, and restaurants' own delivery fleets, you can pretty much get almost any kind of food you want, almost any time of the day, delivered to your home. When I was a kid, it was just pizza, sometimes Chinese, but even Taco Bell and White Castle, all those great places, happy to deliver the delicious and sometimes nutritious food of your choice. Well, sometime in the not overly distant future, we may get a new twist on that. The late night food delivery from your favorite restaurant might arrive at your front door without the delivery person. Cruise Automation, a subsidiary of GM that we've talked about, they make technology for self-driving cars, has teamed up with DoorDash, the popular food delivery place, to test driverless deliveries. Now, during the tests, there will be a safety driver in the automated Chevrolet Bolt EV, but that person will be there only to take over in the event of an emergency. The car will, for the most part, drive on its own. So kind of like a spotter, but everything else is done without a human participating. The test program will take place in San Francisco, where Cruise is based. Ford has also been testing so-called driverless deliveries in partnership with Domino's and Postmates in a very close city, Ann Arbor, and, of course, Miami. But in the case of Ford, the cars are driven by humans and only look like driverless vehicles. With Ford's tests, the drivers are instructed not to interact with customers. The purpose of the tests is to see how customers respond to deliveries where there is no delivery person involved. GM has said that it hopes to someday offer a driverless taxi service, but driverless deliveries are another avenue for it to profit from automated cars. Cruise CEO Dan Ammann said, "Delivery is a significant opportunity for Cruise as we prepare to commercialize our autonomous vehicle technology and transform transportation. Partnering with DoorDash will provide us with critical learnings as we further our mission to deliver technology that makes people's lives better and more convenient." Ammann had until recently been president of GM, but was named CEO of Cruise on November 29th. Kyle Vogt, the co-founder of Cruise, again, the autonomous vehicle division of General Motors, he was CEO, but has stayed on as chief technology officer. Selected DoorDash customers in San Francisco will be able to order meals from local restaurants or fresh grocery items and have them delivered by Cruise automated cars. DoorDash and Cruise will use the program to evaluate operational and safety aspects of automated delivery programs. GM has said they plan to make autonomous ride sharing a big part of its future business. They plan to mass produce self-driving cars and operate them in fleets. And later in 2019, GM plans to begin offering rides in its autonomous cars to paying customers. But for now, food will be the passenger. It's not clear if tipping is expected. So, never know. Order a pizza And no more pizza person. Everything is done through technology and no human interaction. Interesting, to say the least. Adam Lepp here, the computer guy, with Tech Talk on The Talking Place, WWGH Radio. If you're like me, you greatly prefer Windows 7 to Windows 10, and you probably have also noticed that it's getting harder and harder to get Windows 7, so if your current computer uses that operating system, take care of it, because replacing it may be tricky. Microsoft has been urging customers to upgrade from its Windows 7 operating system, while hoping to ease the transition with several options for extended support. It will stop providing routine fixes and security patches effective January of 2020. That's coming pretty soon. Regular support for Windows Server 2008 also is scheduled to end on January 2020. Now, Windows 7 Enterprise customers can subscribe to the ESU, the Extended Security Updates, to receive security fixes for uncovered or reported vulnerabilities in the operating system. But patches will be issued only in cases of threats rated critical or important by Microsoft. Now, those are the two top rankings in Microsoft's four-step scoring system, meaning that performance issues might not be addressed. Moreover, this extended security update, again, for Windows 7 as they're working to phase it out, the ESU, or extended security updates, will be available only in one-year increments and for just 3 years. It'll be sold on a per-device basis instead of the per-user basis that Microsoft has offered for Windows 10. So what do these extended security updates cost? Well, not too bad, $25 to $50 per year per device, but every year the cost will double. So by 2022, it'll be $100 or $200 per device. Customers who subscribe to Microsoft 365 Enterprise will be offered the lower tier pricing. So how many computers currently run Windows 7? Well, more than a third, 37.9%. Windows 10, 40.9%, according to data from Net Market Share. On the business side of the market, Windows 10 accounts for more than 50% of the market. Windows 7 is 10 years old, 2009, you know, time flies. It was a replacement for the not popular Windows Vista, which succeeded Windows XP, released in 2001. Windows Vista, a bit of a disaster. Windows 7 kind of being a major bug fix with more improvements for Vista. Microsoft also plans to end support for Windows Server 2008 and SQL Server applications early in 2020, and they've been encouraging customers to migrate to Azure. I've tried Azure, and I don't like it. So I must say this article is not a very positive one on my end. Unlike with Windows 7, no ESU is planned for Server 2008, leaving the customer with limited options. The end of Windows Server 2008 support is why nearly one-third of companies surveyed said they were considering purchasing new server hardware, according to the recent Spiceworks 2019 State of Servers report. You got a State of the Union, State of the City, State of the State, and you have State of Servers. Nice tongue twisters for you. Zohan Pinhasi, CEO of Monster Cloud, a provider of managed cybersecurity services, said, "Windows 2008 server is the most widely used server on the planet. As a result, it could make a tempting target to hackers once support has ended." He said a lot of organizations moved to Server 2012, but migration is not an easy task. And too often, companies take the approach, if it ain't broken, don't fix it. Criminals are already aware according to Zohar Pinhasi, again from Monster Cloud, criminals are aware that Microsoft will discontinue the support for the operating system in 2020, and research suggests they could be cooking up something big, like taking advantage of zero-day vulnerabilities. Now, as we mentioned, Windows 7 was released as a follow-up to the disappointing Windows Vista. It was very well received, seen as offering the best features and functionality of XP and Vista. In 2012, 3 years after the release of Windows 7, Microsoft took the operating system in a completely new direction with Windows 8, which offered what they called a modern user interface with touchscreen options. The new interface, which was also meant to bridge tablets and PCs, failed to catch on. They took out the start button. They made that confusing Metro interface, and Windows 8 was horrendous. They then released Windows 10 in 2015, a little better, but still doesn't have the traditional interface, the traditional start button that we saw with XP, Vista, and 7. Windows 10 was said to offer the best of Windows 10 was said to offer the best of Windows 7 and Windows 8, as well as a update to Windows 8, 8.1. Of course, there was no Windows 9. 9 might be like Windows 8.1, who knows? Maybe 10 just is a nice, even number. Anyway, because Windows 10 has some resemblance to Windows 7, users have been slow to adopt it. 4 years after release in 2019, Windows 10 is barely surpassing Windows 7 in total users. And that's the problem. They want to phase it out, but it's still very popular. Microsoft has had to support three operating systems, so it's no surprise that they decided to pull the plug on the oldest. Paul Tyke, a principal analyst at Lifter Cloud, said, Windows 7 was introduced 10 years ago in 2009, and that's 70 dog years or internet years, a human lifespan. And yes, 10 years in the computer world is a lot. Roger Kay, another expert, he's from Endpoint Technologies Associates, said, it's hard to happen sometime. Microsoft has extended Windows 7's life a number of times. What makes the transition difficult is that Windows 7 has done its job quite well, remaining a very stable operating system. Still, supporting multiple operating systems is not only a drain on resources, but also is inconsistent with Microsoft's new direction. Roger Kay said Microsoft is committed to pushing everyone onto Windows 10, which is better adapted to a services revenue stream. In fact, there may never be another Windows. The company will keep updating the Windows 10 code essentially indefinitely. Now, beta versions of new code get pushed out. Bug reports come back, and the team patches whatever needs it. In the past, a barrier to upgrading was the hardware that past versions of Windows ran on, and making a move from Windows 3.1 to Windows 95 almost certainly required that users purchase a new computer. The same trend continued with Windows 98, Millennium, or ME, or Me, XP, and Windows Vista. Now, by the time Windows 7 came along, Moore's law of ever faster processors seemed to slow down. Essentially, it means that between approximately 18 and 24 months, processors double in speed, but there obviously is a limit. You can't get faster and faster and faster, and doubling as quickly as every 2 years. So that law has slowed down, but the general concept is still in existence. Now, apart from some PC games, most software really doesn't require vastly improved hardware. That made the transition from Windows Vista to Windows 7 much easier. And even today, an upgrade to a new operating system isn't really that much of a stretch. Paul Tyke said, Windows 7 first shipped on 45-nanometer Intel Core processors codenamed Yorkfield and Penryn, which both debuted in 2008. The 45-nanometer Core i5 Linfield desktop processor was introduced at the same time as Windows 7, as was the 45-nanometer Core i7 Clarksfield mobile processor. The so-called sweet spot for Intel Core processors at the time was quad-core for both mobile and desktop, while the core clock frequency ranges for all those processors started at 2.3 GHz and topped out above 3 GHz. A current generation Core i5 Skylake desktop processor has a base frequency of 2.6 to 3.6 GHz and two dual-threaded cores. Running four threads is still a sweet spot. Today, mobile Core i3 processors have two dual-threaded cores and frequencies as high as 3.6 GHz. So Paul Tyke, again the expert we quoted earlier, said in 10 years, we didn't get faster clock speeds except at the very high end of Intel's product line. AMD, which is a processor maker that competes with Intel, they're kind of like Coke and Pepsi. AMD could not do any better because physics is physics. We got some speed ups due to architectural improvements. But really, Moore's Law, again, the law that says that processors double in speed every 18 to 24 months, is dead. It slowed down, but we're still getting faster. Now, given that we haven't seen a great leap forward in hardware, has meant in most cases that older PCs could be upgraded, something Microsoft initially offered for free. Hardware-wise, any system that can run Windows 7 can run Windows 10, according to the expert Roger Kay. That part is easy, and he says, I've upgraded a bunch of older systems. Windows 7 was designed to run well on whatever was running Windows Vista, so it didn't require more computer power than was available several years before it shipped. And the Windows 10 updater essentially looks for a valid Windows 7 or Windows 8 license. Moreover, Windows 10 was designed to run well on any PC that can run Windows 7 to appeal to both Windows 7 and Windows 8 upgrades. He said it wasn't a hard goal because Windows 10 focused on an easy-to-install and easy-to-update architecture, as well as better security and improving the user experience, none of which required more processor speed. So the biggest reason, according to the experts, to upgrade from Windows 7 remains security, even with this extended service agreement for Microsoft. Users could be at risk. It's already known that criminals are cooking up stuff in their labs. Once they have the tools, they can exploit the older versions of Windows to make billions from it. Ransomware, such as the WannaCry crypto worm that we've talked about, which demands money to unencrypt your files. It targeted Windows machines almost 2 years ago, in May of 2017, and it could possibly be unleashed after Microsoft support for Windows 7 ends. That particular ransomware was propagated through Eternal Blue, an exploit developed by the United States National Security Agency, the NSA. The hackers dropped a package that was stolen from the NSA, and hackers could use something similar. Now, the best course of action is not to invest in the ESU from Microsoft, but to upgrade the operating system and, if necessary, even the PC hardware. Roger Entner is from Recon Analytics. He said it's time to move on. The demise of a loved operating system is hard, but inevitable. Windows 7 stopped being the flagship Windows operating system 7 years ago So it is time to upgrade. And a laptop for $179 at Best Buy runs Windows 10 and is probably more powerful than anything that was made in 2012. There's no reason that anyone running Windows 7 should stick with it, other than pure ornery stubbornness. And it's not like you have to learn a new operating system. Of course, it isn't just individual users who should pay attention to these warnings. Companies should really get off Windows 7 as soon as they can, according to the expert Roger Kay. He said security attacks are getting more frequent, more sophisticated, and more automated. And don't imagine that just because you're a small fish, they won't come after you. Small firms are sometimes used as an attack vector against larger firms. And if companies need to turn over their PC base once every 10 years, that's a good thing. Employees might even be more productive. So some words from the experts on migrating from Windows 7 to Windows 10. As I've mentioned, I don't like Windows 10, but the inevitable will certainly occur at some time. Adam Lepp here, the computer guy, on The Talking Place, all about technology and how it affects our daily lives. We are WWGH Radio in Marion, 107.1 FM. That's 107.1 megahertz, and of course, broadcasting online because of the power and wonderfulness of computers and the internet. WWGH1071.com. Have you ever left your refrigerator door open? It should just close on its own, but sometimes it doesn't happen. Or maybe you just crack it a little bit so it stays open, then you go to the bathroom, watch a TV show, or forget about it. Well, we have the solution for you. Why wouldn't we have a smart appliance that would solve that life-altering dilemma? It is from Samsung, maker of smartphones and other smart devices. It has something called the SmartThings app. The new Samsung Family Hub 4.0 refrigerator will give you a smoother interface to use that builds on previous generations' app improvements. So, for example, you can still go to the grocery store and check if your refrigerator has milk, just like before. But now, the fridge can also let you know if you've left the door open. Kind of spooky almost, that almost like a little man inside the refrigerator telling you about this stuff. So I guess it's good and it's certainly cool, but again, a little creepy if you ask my opinion. Samsung says it wants to make the refrigerator into an intelligent home assistant and less of a simple home appliance. There's a feature called the personalized family board that will let users add and customize their activities and interests. Meanwhile, Samsung has redesigned the home screen of the refrigerator's display to be more functional and easy to use. Now, in 2018, yes, that was last year, Samsung added capabilities of its smart software called Bixby that we've talked about a few times. It was added to its Family Hub smart refrigerator. And this year, in 2019, it says Bixby has been enhanced, tweaking voice commands to be more conversational and interactive by including more natural language. Samsung is also announcing a new smart front load washer that connects to Wi-Fi. Now, that sounds kind of interesting. There's a super speed mode that's new, which is supposed to wash your clothes faster by extracting more water than previous Samsung machines. Price and availability have not yet been announced for either the smart refrigerator or the smart washer. Now, as you may imagine, Samsung designing more of these new smart home appliances every year. The progress between each generation of these gadgets seems incremental, but quite significant if you add up what's changed within four generations of updates to Bixby and the user interface. Now, Bixby is not as popular, as well-known, or as smart as Alexa from Amazon, or, of course, Google Assistant, but it certainly is improving. So, again, we have smart cars and smart almost everything else. Like to see more smart politicians, but we can discuss that on a different show. But we have improvements in smart appliances here at a radio station that's smart enough to know that talk radio is where it's at. Yes, the talking place. WWGH Radio. Approaching the top of the hour, 10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 9 a.m. Central Daylight Time. So wherever you're listening from, we thank you very much. Hopefully your ears have enjoyed the experience and we have sharpened a few brain cells. I return to the airwaves this Thursday morning about 13 minutes after 9 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. But hey, don't touch that dial. Coming up at the top of the hour, we have messages from our many celebrity guests and friends of the station. Messages from our valued supporters and underwriters, previews of past, present, and future shows, news with Scott, weather with Zach, and obituaries produced and voiced by yours truly. And then following the 10 a.m. features, it is Talking Points with Satch Sullinger. Again, Scott takes the airwaves after the noon features, open phone lines and trivia the first hour, and then for the 101st time on this station, drum roll, please. Dr. Ron L. Fineman, talking about politics, presidents, current events, and just about everything else in the news. And that's right after the 1 o'clock features. Be sure to go to our website to find out more about the station, as well as listen to and download previous programs. WWGH1071.com.
See you later, alligator. What you told me nearly made me lose my head. When the thought of what you told me nearly made me lose my head. But the next time that I saw her, reminded her of what she said. See you later, alligator. Said, wait a minute, Gator. I know you mean it just for play.